Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have some quick opening comments and some news, after which we're going to talk a lot about 2.0 and the new chapter packs that have been announced. And then finally we're going to have some quick closing comments.
John, it's episode 30 and I'm so excited. Game of Thrones 2.0 is on the boat.
Yay, the boat.
Yay, 4 to 6 weeks. And, yes. And if the stuff doesn't show up exactly on the 4th, they'll be bitching all over the boards.
This is
the way of things. But it did go on the boat on the 24th. So that
is good. I mean, it's a great
start.
Thing. It just means that we have to wait that much longer for the first chapter pack. And I'm kind of sad because I've had my core set for a long time thanks to Gen Con, so for me it's a really long wait for the first chapter pack.
Oh, the you poor thing getting your core set at Gen Con. You poor thing. I don't have a ton of news I wanted to go into. We'd love to share the results of the Brawl at the Crossroads Inn,
but they didn't post them, those dirty. What I want to know is why the people from the Brawl at the Crossroads Inns didn't fill out the annals.
Maybe
is it because they're lazy? Is it because they hate us?
It's Helmet. He's not lazy. He must just hate us. Yeah, I guess Helmet hates us now. Oh, yeah. Well. It's disappointing. We got nothing. There is a definitely a piece of regular news. The third chapter pack for Game of Thrones 2.0 was announced in the little announcement article, but we're going to get into that later in far too much detail, so maybe we should skip over that for now.
I think so.
There's a couple minor items of news that I was told to mention. So for those of you going to the UK Nationals, which are still a few weeks from now, and I'm sure we'll talk about them more, some of the people attending sort of wanted to turn this into unofficially a black tie event. Dress up for the Nationals. And
wear your suit, wear your tie.
Exactly, which, is a neat idea. It certainly will stand out from the rest of the crowd at this convention. So we thought we'd at least mention that here. Obviously, there's no official obligation. This is not something coming through the distributor or anything like that, but there's a fair portion of the community that's trying to push for it to become an unofficial black tie event, and we thought we'd start plugging that now since most of you don't own any suits or no.
And it would mean that if Alex was going to the event, it would take him at least another 20 minutes to get ready because he couldn't tie a tie.
That was a secret.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I'm terrible. I tie a tie once a year, so obviously it's a YouTube video every time. which would actually tie into, well, I wish it did because it doesn't, but it would have been a great pun. I do have one more thing, though. This is I don't know how to say this without either meaning sounding somewhat condescending or sounding like it's something it isn't. It really is meant to be a cry out to some of you listeners and other people who like to get engaged in podcasts. For 2 weeks running now, the White Book has had to – Kenan has had to fly solo and been asking for some people to be emergency co-hosts, people he can flag down to help. Kenan does all the work on that podcast. He's put in a ton of work. Mm-hmm. If it's something that you're interested in, we're always looking for guests as well. But right now, I think it's really important to make sure that we get all these podcasts going early on in the community, doing yeah. Well. And so if you've got a topic idea or something like that, or if you're just willing to record, I think they tend to record on Wednesday nights, and it's a night that you can make free some of the time, and you could be either a backup co-host or a co-host for the White Book. I strongly recommend you flag down Kenan, because I think that certainly having some scheduling issues with his current co-hosts.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like Kenan's just doing the White Book. He did 2C, 1C. They really are the longest running podcast, and it kills me to say it on air. But, if you can help them out to make sure that he doesn't have to do it solo, that would be awesome. today we're actually joined by a community pillar. This is Stanton. How long have you been playing for?
I've been playing since the game came out, so like 2002, I think, 2001.
2002, so you're a serious old school player. Because I remember handing you a deck at a, I think a warm-up tournament in like 2011 or something.
Yeah.
You could play in that event because you were angry with the way that Baratheon was going at the time. You ended up playing Martell.
Yeah, because it was like the normal world's rotation where like Barry's been like really strong this whole regional season. Now it's time to nerf them so they don't win worlds. I actually had, like, I don't think 1.0 has been a very healthy environment for a number of years now, which is why I haven't been playing at all, because it's just frustrating.
But you've been back in 2.0, and you've been back hardcore, because we've seen you streaming videos from Octagon. What do you think of 2.0?
I actually love 2.0, and I love that it's more about challenges now. It's not about, like, who can control the board the hardest. Like, you actually get to do challenges now, and they matter.
All right, so we got Stanton joining us, and he's going to be talking with us about the recent posters that FFG has put up talking about their new chapter packs that are expanding on their core set of Game of Thrones 2.0. The first of which is actually called The King's Peace.
Nope. The first of which is called Taking the Black.
But damn,
nice try, John.
Why did you link that one first, Mr. Alex?
He actually linked them in reverse order. That's why I had to like rearrange them.
It would mess with me.
I figured that you'd click the first one, then the second one, then the third one, so your newest tab would be the third one, which is Taking the Black, which is the one we're starting on.
That is the most Canadian thing I've heard all day.
So this first article came out a while back, and we didn't really dig into it because we didn't have the core set and we didn't know all of the cards, and so it was kind of hard to either judge some of the cards they were spoiling and some of the ideas they were pitching. But this article announces both the cycle and the chapter pack, which is kind of confusing because some of the card numbers are from cards in like third or fourth chapter pack. But it's mostly, I wanted to start with that Nate French intro on the Westeros cycle, where he basically says that he wants to throw things back to the first book and focus on that where possible without adding additional rules to the game, sort of expand it. And he draws attention to the fact that it's to rapidly increase the number of plots in the environment by adding 18 new plots to the game, including a loyal plot for each faction. So how do you guys feel about that?
I am really excited about that, because I think we need more plots. Plots are one of the center points of Game of Thrones. It's something that differentiates it from every other game I've ever played. I think it's awesome that they're focusing on that.
Yeah, I also think that's a really good idea to increase the plot pool, because that's where your customization can have a much larger impact on the way your deck plays. And I love that they're not trying to shove too much all at once. Like, if they're trying to introduce another, you know, gimmicky
keyword,
like
shadows or something, yeah.
Right, like they did with 1.0. It seemed like they were trying to do a new gimmick every chapter pack cycle, and then they would just forget about it. So I'm glad that they're not trying to do that right now. They're just trying to, okay, have these themes we set up in the core set, and we're going to try to expand on those.
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of increasing the plot pool because of the reasons you guys mentioned, but also it's one of the easiest ways to generate reliable, consistent differences in play, because it's not subject to random draw, so you add this card into your deck and it will change the game, and the game will play out differently. And so by increasing that pool, I think that's a really good decision. I'm not entirely sold, despite the fact that the ones we've seen so far look really neat, on making the loyal plots in there, because that means that's 8 plots that can't be used by all the factions, and therefore, so you're adding 18, but 8 of them are just being added to one faction. So I'm a little torn there. I mean, I was pretty convinced that they were going to explore that space for plots eventually. I'm just not sure the first cycle was the place to do it.
I mean, at the same time, it adds a little bit of theme and a little bit of value to these characters. So like Stanton was saying, the fact that they're not trying to create all these new mechanics, but they're trying to focus on the themes that created in the core set is good. And these plots, I'm hoping, because we haven't seen them all, obviously, will be focusing on the theme of each faction and giving it more value or more synergies. And that could be cool.
Yeah, and I think that the thing you want to do the most is make sure that you give each house a distinct feel. And I think a really good way to do that is to give a loyal plot so that you can really drive home, you know, this is how, like, Stark plays. This is how Greyjoy plays.
All right. Well, moving on a little bit to maybe some of the cards that they go into. The first one that catches my eye is from that first spread that's obviously for the entire cycle, not for the pack. And it's this one called Vengeance for Elia. It's a 2-cost Martell event that says, interrupt when claim is applied and we can't see anything else. And I think I'm probably not the only one. A lot of people saw this card and thought, this is going to be Red Vengeance again, isn't it?
Yep.
That would be my guess.
So I guess 2 gold is equivalent to 2 influence, sort of, and this is just going to redirect claim. For those of you who are not familiar with Red Vengeance, it allowed you to basically force the opponent who won the challenge against you to suffer claim instead of yourself, which was a very good stall tactic and a powerful event. But in the end of the game, it didn't see that much play anymore.
Not see that much play because of the influence requirement?
That may have been the main reason, yeah.
Yeah. I think that if it's the standard Red Vengeance text, it'll be awesome. Now, with so little text, we have no idea what it's actually going to do. However, the fact that they've taken away Burning on the Sands, it goes a long way in reducing the effectiveness of this, because they don't have too many stall cards in one faction yet, which I think was a problem in 1.0.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Other cards in that spread, there's one we'll maybe talk about him a little later. There's one that's clearly Moon Boy, but we'll see him better in 2 more chapter packs. But front and center, there's the first of our loyal plots.
For the Watch.
Yeah, someone want to read that?
So For the Watch, it's obviously a loyal Night's Watch plot. It has 4 gold, 6 initiative, 1 claim, and a 6 reserve, with a limit 1 per plot deck. The text is, you cannot lose, and your opponent cannot win. The first challenge initiated against you each phase.
Now, for me, that's a swing and a hit. This is the plot that makes, what's that called, Sword in the Darkness, actually worthwhile.
Awesome.
The one where
yeah.
your opponent, yeah. where you have to win a challenge on defense, and then you can lock them out of other challenges. Well, you have to
guarantees
win it by 5
you.
Or more, so here they're going to make that chump challenge, and then you can play this and lock them out of their challenges. Before, it was really, really hard to do. They wouldn't declare the chump challenge against you if you had the likelihood of being able to play that event.
Mm-hmm. But now they have really no choice. Like, what are they going to do? Attack you with 10 strength of character and lose automatically? And if they do, great. Let the second attack come that's a chump challenge, then block that, win it, and get the For the Watch to lock out the last challenge.
The other thing that I think is really huge here is that this just isn't the first challenge of the phase. This is the first challenge against you. So even if they force you to go first, which isn't likely since this has like 6 initiative. So even if you were to go first, it doesn't matter. It's not like you're wasting that on offense.
And it's also, just because you reread that, it's each phase. And I know that came up as a question, I think, on the FFG forums. It was like, why does it say each phase? And we had to explain that.
Epic battles.
I really hope they don't. But this is the sort of future-proofing that you need if you will eventually add challenges in other phases. And maybe it's not epic battles. Maybe it's Lucas Blackwood. You know, when he died, you get to initiate a military challenge.
I see Lucas Blackwood way more than, like, epic battles. I think epic battles were not elegant at all.
No.
I think Lucas Blackwood is much more elegant. I really like something along that idea.
Mm-hmm. But if we have it, then this plot is already built in as a very solid sort of card. And I know this is the kind of thing that has come up elsewhere as well, because people are asking why Dracarys is not a challenges action if it says participating character. But it's possible that we could have challenges happen outside of the challenges phase. So, you know, again, it looks like future-proofing of the rules, not stupid templating.
Which is awesome, actually, right? Like, the fact that FFG and their playtesters are thinking in that mindset the whole time. They're always saying, okay, I know that this is what it's supposed to do now.
Let's think of all the things that broke in first edition.
Exactly, make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yep.
that the other cards there, I mean, we don't need to read every card and go into them unless they're particularly interesting, but that Maester's Chain looks like it'll make the Maester trait somewhat relevant. It actually looks like it's choosing a
condition attachment.
So maybe it's giving you that Crescent effect on any Maester. That's kind of
Tin Link from first set?
It's only condition attachment.
Yeah, it is only condition attachment.
Okay.
And it's a dominance action.
All right, so what you're saying is it's not as great at all. But Milk of the Poppy.
Right. But Milk of the Poppy.
Exactly. Yeah, which I think is actually really good. I think the meta right now of three Milk of the Poppies is somewhat kind of bad, just because it comes down to, because there aren't a lot of answers to characters like, you know, Bob or Red Viper or Stannis or something. So it comes down to who can get your Milk of the Poppy first. So this at least takes like variance out of the equation a little bit.
Well, there need to be more attachment removal tools when attachments are quite good. And in this version of the game, they are. They certainly are. So moving on to the next spread, we get another plot of the Rapid Expansion. This is actually Must of the Realm, which is a 4-5-1 edict with 6 reserve. And basically, during a challenge where you have an attacking army, raise the claim value on it by 1. And the thing that comes to me from that plot is that if you have an army with an intrigue icon or an army with a power icon, that matters.
Yeah.
This can be a conditional 4-5-2 on the challenges that you build your deck for, and that would make it better than the 3-4-2, which is the other claim to plot that we can sort of compare it to.
And it's got a nice reserve. Like 6 is pretty solid.
Yeah, it's higher than, I think the 3-4-2 is only reserve 5, right?
Yep,
I think so.
Yeah. And then the rest of the article gives us 2 Night's Watch cards, given that the chapter pack is called Taking the Black. Someone want to read out Will?
Sure. He's got Stealth, Insight. He's 4 cost for both a military and an intrigue icon for 3 strength, which breaks a little bit from the Night's Watch theme of having, you know, monocons. He's a ranger, so you expect the military icon, but not so much the intrigue. And his force reaction is, after you lose an unopposed challenge, sacrifice a ranger character you control. So that stealth and insight probably means he's going to be drawing you cards solo in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I would say so. And he is a loyal card as well.
Yes, absolutely. Which makes a lot of sense. I mean, draw should probably
exactly.
be. Yeah.
They've been tying draw to loyalty, and I think that's a wise decision overall. So this is basically the same loss condition as the wall, right? The wall kneels if you lose an unopposed challenge. Mm-hmm. This one says, if you lose an unopposed challenge, sacrifice a ranger. So can you afford to put him out early game, or is he a later game once you can block those challenges?
I think he might even be early game. Like, stealth and insight on a 4 coster, that is pretty sweet.
You're going to lose an unopposed on the first 2 turns, right?
Are you really?
I don't think so. I honestly don't think so, because I think at least for the first couple turns, but even into like the later game too, Night's Watch do not care about winning challenges. Yep. Do not care.
Will himself does. You invested 4 gold in a character with insight, and you're not going to use that.
He's got stealth. He's winning the challenge on his own. Either a military or an intrigue, he's winning it.
Yeah.
And at 3 strength, I think insight certainly works on defense too, so he doesn't necessarily need to be attacking either.
I don't know. I think he's a phenomenal card. I think he's a very interesting design point, and I think he's pushing the not losing unopposed challenges from a more offensive perspective than the wall. And that, I think, is interesting, and it's a way to expand upon that theme.
That is actually a good point, that he is kind of like giving Night's Watch more tools, but you have to temper that. You can't get greedy and try and start, you know, winning more challenges like on offense, like this guy certainly encourages you to, because then you're going to get punished by it if your defense isn't as strong.
Yeah. And I like I like that he plays differently versus the other factions, because against Greyjoy, I'd be much more worried about playing him early game than I would against Lannister, for instance, because I know Greyjoy has those other stealth, other guys and the power challenges that Will can't participate in, right, or push through with a big guy. Well, the other houses, I might be more willing to play him early because I don't think they're going to be able to not get that unopposed.
And it is worth noting that sometimes trading the insight draw for losing a ranger is worth it, especially if you think the wildfire is coming up soon, that kind of stuff, which is something that a Night's Watch has to be able to deal with. Why not lose a ranger if you need more cards in hand?
Yep.
Certainly.
There is one last card that I think is quite interesting and worth talking about here, and that's the Watch's Need. Stanton, would you care to read that one for us?
Oh, yeah. So the Watch Has Need is a non-loyal Night's Watch event. Costs 1 gold. Action. Name a trait. Builder, ranger, or steward. Search the top X cards of your deck for any number of characters with that trait, reveal them, and add them to your hand. Shuffle the other cards back into your deck. X is your reserve value. Play this on a Counting Coppers turn and have all the cards.
Yeah, and it's not just limited to 10 with Counting Coppers. Technically, it's 11. If you have Sam in play, right? He's a reserve boost.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Or the Iron Throne.
It's kind of cheating that whole draw has to be loyal thing, because this is basically draw, but it's kind of loyal despite not being loyal, in that you're only going to be able to dig for Night's Watch characters. So if you're running this as your banner faction, you kind of have to run a lot of Night's Watch characters to make it work.
Yeah, but I've seen decks out there that utilize heavily like the Night's Watch stuff and almost use like the main house as like the banner house.
Yeah, I have seen that as well. Although it seems like a very painful to lose on what Aemon and the Messenger Ravens are loyal.
For sure.
Hard to pass up on those.
Yeah, I agree, but I think like as the card pool expands, this could certainly be interesting, like out of house.
I think what interests me a lot about this card is sort of the way it really fits the name. You're sitting there with the card in hand and you're like, damn it, I don't have any intrigue icons. Well, you know what the Watch has need of? Intrigue icons. Let's go look for stewards. And, you know, you sort of get this feeling, you're like, damn, I need the intrigue icons to plug this hole so that Will isn't costing me rangers or whatever it is. And so you play this, and even if you're only looking at the top, 10 for stewards, of which are only a quarter of your characters, you'll probably find one and you'll be able to block that intrigue challenge. And I think it's neat that to me the name evokes what it does so well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think thematically it might have been a little bit better to have the traits be like bastard and like traitor, but I'll take it.
Any thoughts on that first article before we move on to the next one?
No, I think we can probably move on to the next. And the next one is it the road or the King's Peace, Mr. Backwards?
It's the road.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you go forward or backwards. The middle one's always the middle one, John.
Whoa. Who knows what you've done, Alex? Because you've made all the clicking crazy. So we'll go with the road to Winterfell.
Well, in the sort of text where they describe it, there's a line that really has me squinting and wondering what on earth they've done. Because they have this thing that says, and you'll find a Targaryen attachment so powerful it's limited to one copy per deck.
But where's that attachment?
Well, they don't show it to us. But I'm not.
Why would they
sure
do that?
Why do you want to limit one per deck, especially at this stage of the game?
What Targaryen attachment could be limit one per deck? Like maybe a Valyrian sword they have?
I don't think they actually have any.
They have Blackfyre, but they don't know where it is, so they don't.
Right. Yes. My guess, actually, is...
Could be the three dragon eggs as one. Gift of dragon eggs or something.
Right, that would be my guess. It, like, lets you search out dragons and put them into your hand, like, one copy of each.
I mean, what I worry about is that limiting to one copy per deck makes it clunky, but it doesn't make a card not broken. It just...
If it's really that powerful.
If the reason for the limit one per deck is the power level, yeah. If it does something weird like it starts in play or something like that, then fine, right?
If it's Khal Drogo's, horse.
Well, I don't know. Like, maybe if some effect where you wind up searching your deck, or it starts in play, or it comes into play from your deck. I don't know.
Or when you play character X, it automatically comes into play.
Yeah, or gets.
How would that even
play,
like,
Jogo, and Jogo's whip appears in his hand? I mean.
But yeah, I mean, there'd be some funky mechanics there. But then I'm fine with it being limit one per deck. But if you're trying to say, well, this is a really good card, it's so good that you're going to win the game when you draw it, so we're going to make it really hard to draw it, that's terrible balancing.
Yeah.
Isn't that exactly what they did with the Denarcries or whatever, the burn? They said, this is super powerful, so we're going to make it hard to use.
What, Dracaris?
Yeah.
Dracaris isn't hard to use.
Well, it kind of is, in that there are only four characters you can use to trigger it. So
I mean, that's obviously how they were trying to balance it.
I guess, but like it would make it a little bit harder if you didn't immediately want three copies of every single one of those in your deck.
Yes. Although in the long run you may not want three copies.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a short term thing, right?
Yeah. Like who knows what's gonna happen in the future when Valor comes back. Like it's always been said that Valor will come back sooner or later. You know, that might be three chapter packs from now, and that might be in this chapter pack. We have no idea.
That might make it harder to run triplicates of weenies. Now, in that first spread of cards, is there a card that jumps out to you guys? Like
the Reader's Back. Come on now.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, a five-cost Reader, by the way.
Yeah, but still, come on. Champ card coming back. It's awesome.
Oh, no, I'm like super excited about it. I'm like, excited for what he could do.
It may be the exact same text as first edition. After you win an unopposed challenge in which a unique Greyjoy character is participating, draw a card or discard the top three cards of your opponent's deck. Limit
it's
once per
probably
phase.
This I would guess the exact same wording.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bet they haven't changed it at all except for the cost.
But that would work. I mean, it has to be loyal because it's a draw engine. It works off unopposed, still has the phenomenal art, and because it was a three cost character before, it's a five cost character now. That seems to fit for me. It seems to be a really easy transition, but this means champ cards are back. This is the first champ card we've seen.
We knew they were going to come back, just like they had in from the CCG era to the LCG era. So it's great that they're coming back, and it's great that those faces are literally in, you know, going to be there forever, like FFG said. So
oh,
winning back card
design. He doesn't have the naval icon anymore. You
know? Well, because naval doesn't exist at all.
Because that was
right, to our knowledge.
Yeah, I hope Naval never comes back.
Oh, come on. My best two successes in tournaments were Black Sails decks.
And for once, that is the least of my worries.
Other cards, I mean, there's a reprint of Royal Entourage that looks nothing like the old Royal Entourage.
It's not even similar.
No.
Well, it's cheap, military power, free strength.
It's not
bicon.
Free.
Yeah.
After you lose an intrigue, you have to kneel him, which I guess is all right, but he's not similar at all.
He has the same name. I kind of like that effect, though. This is sort of the idea of, like, if someone outsmarts you or makes you look bad in court, then your entourage sort of is like, we don't know that guy.
I mean, just, like, looking at it in the context of the card pool right now, you can't tell me that in Bear of Fealty, this guy isn't immediately replacing the Vanguard Lancey.
Well, I don't know if he's replacing him, but you're definitely going to put three.
Play both.
Yeah,
maybe.
I don't know. I think. So what else could this guy replace in Bear Fealty?
Well, I don't know. It depends what we're putting in the first cycle and what sort of synergy we get. Well, and it also depends if we get ally hate, because they do seem to be seeding this ally trait on a couple of things.
I'm kind of hoping that Mercenary becomes a new ally. I don't know. I actually didn't like that you were punished for being an ally.
Oh, I didn't mind being punished for being an ally. I'm just not a huge fan of it being automatic on things like Eris Okart, where you just come into play and you basically get to 2-for-1. You get a great character and you get rid of an ally. I would be more of a fan of you being able to, you know, having a kneel that can kneel one character or two allies or that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. I'd be okay with that
where it's conditionally more vulnerable to soft control or hard control as well. It's like kill one character or two allies or mercenaries. You know, like they're more
speaking
fickle.
Of soft control, Alex. What's up with Brothel Maiden, who is sick?
when I first saw Brothel Maiden, I thought, that looks an awful lot like a girl I toured Southern Germany with. I'm a very lucky man.
You are a lucky man. Good for you, Alex.
Yeah, nice job, man.
Yep. It's a neat card. It's interacting with that gold generation theme. It's interacting with the sort of manipulating and prioritizing different challenges that the Lanny seems to be doing. And it has wording that clearly says, we don't want this to be broken when you have two or three of them on the board.
Yeah.
Because you could really imagine this locking down a game. You get two Bomber Atoms, and it's like your opponent cannot initiate military challenges against you. That's just not going to happen. But now it's, even if you have two, all they have to do is give you a gold.
And you're good.
Or if there's another effect later on that allows them to give you a gold, they could use that as a way to bypass the military challenge restriction. So it's kind of interesting.
But yeah, I think it's great. I think it's really thematic for Lannister. I love the fact that gold right now in 2.0 is a premium. People play some plots specifically just because they're high gold. And this card in late game can be a factor. That one extra gold actually makes more difference now, even though the gold curve is higher, I think, than it did in 1.0.
Yeah, and I like that Lannister is kind of setting itself up to be like the go-to banner house, because they have so many non-loyal gold generation cards. It's like ridiculous.
Yeah, but they're subtly different, the non-loyal. I mean, for instance, Tyrion is in the challenges phase, so it makes you approach the cost curve somewhat differently and say, okay, yeah, the ambush works, or I can play these events, but it doesn't necessarily just mean that you get to flood the board different, right?
Well,
love that Lannister has a theme, right? A unique theme, and it's gold. And as long as no other house gets that or faction, I'm really happy. Because, you know, Baratheon's Neil now. So it's cool that Lannister has a theme, and it's a theme that's working and actually useful in 2.0. Because gold means so much more.
Well, speaking of things gold can do, you want to read out that next plot?
Sure. Wardens of the West. It is 5-4-1, so 5 gold, 4 initiative, 1 claim, 6 reserve. It has a reaction. After you win an intrigue challenge, pay 2 gold to have the losing opponent choose and discard 2 cards from his or her hand. So early game, this bitch can hurt you a lot.
Yeah, this card is like straight up ridiculous. If you have Cersei and you just win 1 intrigue challenge, you're discarding 4 cards.
But it's a huge gambit, right? Because you're taking a gambit that your board presence currently can match their board presence, because
without spending that while saving 2 gold.
While spending that 2 gold.
I mean, if you have Tyrion, it's easier, but if you don't.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, you're spending 2 gold, so you have 3 to marshal, and you're still hoping to have a superior board presence, because even if you wipe their hand right now, there's no hard reset in the meta. So it's not like you can Valor next turn, blow up the boards, and say, okay, now I'm at a huge advantage because I have all these extra cards on you. What you're saying is, I hope my wildfire is going to bring us down to a point where I'm still in an advantage and you don't have any cards and I do.
The other thing to note, too, is that since reactions happen before claim now, this will reduce your hand size before you have to random discard.
Yeah.
Which, and I'm really glad this is, like, all the loyal ones seem to be, like, 1 plot per deck.
Yeah, this could, I agree. Although it's worth noting the reaction is not limits 1 per phase or whatever.
Correct.
You could
win
2 intrigue challenges and trigger this twice, or you could win an intrigue challenge on defense and trigger it.
If you had to full gold.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So, again, 2 gold each time, but certainly your opponent's not going to initiate an intrigue challenge against you when you have Tyrion on the board if there's any chance that you might win it. Because he's like, thank you for the 2 free gold. Thank you for the fact that you have to lose 2 more cards, so on. Now, obviously, this will probably lose value in the later game when your intrigue claim pressure might have stripped their hand already.
Yeah, where it doesn't matter at that point. Paying 2 gold to get 0 cards is useless.
But the early game, it is a 5 gold scheme, so it's not affected by naval superiority. It's a fairly safe 5 gold plot that if you have the resource advantage or the board position advantage, you can turn that into card advantage. And I think that's Lanny. I think it's really nice. I also think that looks sort of like an Ewan McGregor tie-in. No? Am I making that up?
Yes, you are making things up again, Alex.
Sadly. I kind of like when I first saw it, I kind of thought that he had just come from like Sergeant Pepper.
Okay.
Like he's like that outfit just looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could see you, McGregor.
All right. Well, the next article we have is The King's Peace, the one that John thought was first.
Well, it's very confusing, Alex, the way that you link them, I'm just saying.
So, John, want to start us off with anything that catches your eye in that first spread or in the first parts of the articles?
I mean, the Moon Boy reminds me of someone I know, so how about we read that? For 2 gold, Baratheon, says, after you lose a challenge in something Moon Boy is participating, discard 1 card from your hand.
Okay, but we actually saw him on the first article, so we can
where
see the rest
insight.
Of
insight.
Where we
right.
saw that he was 2 strength, power monocon, and had insight.
Yes. So it seems like actually a really interesting draw mechanic where if you can win with him, you can get cards, but if you lose with them, you're going to be discarding cards.
And it's worth noting that in the first article, you can see random.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see.
Yeah. So it's a random card from your hand. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is not good.
But he has to be in the challenge. So just, you can't use him to chump challenge, and you can't use him to chump block, which is what you normally use weenies for.
Right.
Right.
But he's got draw, and he's got draw off power challenges, which, you know, the red keep is already helping you with, which Bera has the strength to pull off those power challenges. So if you're doing well, if you've got a nice solid board position at the start of the game, this guy will just help fuel things. But when things start to fall apart, he's going to be someone you are going to be afraid to put into challenges.
So what you're saying is he's win more?
He's win more, but he's...
Because he's great when you're ahead and not super good when you're behind?
Well, he's great when you're ahead on power. The rest of the board doesn't really matter. So he's win more, yes, but he's win more to a very specific
only
aspect
power
of the game. Yeah.
Right.
And I think the power icon is probably the icon that is everyone has like at least some of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. It's not like there's any house that's just like, oh, man.
Power's my weakness, yeah.
You can look at some houses and say intrigue's a weakness or military's a weakness, but yeah, I don't think of any house and think, oh, power's their weakness.
Right, exactly, yeah. So... That's certainly, if it was like an intrigue icon, I think it would be just loads better. But as a power icon, I don't know. I might put like 1 in my deck.
Oh, I think he's better than that. I think with things like the Red Keep and with the other pressure you have for power challenges in Bera, I think he's a draw engine that you can get running early on, and I think he's really, really strong.
He's cheap, too. He's still 2 gold.
Yeah, I think putting multiple copies in, though, like, it's not a card that like, you want to rely on.
No,
come
that's
on.
True.
He's a fool, Sten. How many fools do you want in your deck? You want more than one.
I mean, I'd have 60 if I could, but...
Yeah, like... But right above him in the article, actually, is what used to be Newly Made Lord. Before that was Bandit Lord, I think.
Yeah, before it was a neutral... CCG yep. card called Bandit Lord, which was reprinted almost a straight reprint, except it was Greyjoy, and called Newly Made Lord, and I assume it's going to be called Newly Made Lord again.
You sure it's not going to be called, like, Third Time's a Charm Lord?
And I assume the text will be fairly similar, because we can see cost 3 in there.
Yeah, it's the same card for 4
cost,
I'm sure.
It's probably going to be a forced reaction, right? Which means that you can interrupt it and cancel it. Unlike Newly Made Lord, which was a passive. And if it also has the non-limited trait, it does mean it fills a different niche because all the economy we've seen so far is limited.
Yeah.
So this is no longer a choke card. It's still a really, really, really strong card when everybody's relying on their locations for draw.
For draw, exactly.
So right. if it is very similar to the old version, maybe it says when he comes into play, pay 2 gold to choose a location and then destroy it, and then it becomes part of the play.
But it's going to be the same text, just like the reader.
Text, then it's a really strong card, but it loses that choke versatility because so basically there is no non-limited economy for it to hit.
So since we're talking about traits, we got Fool. We have a Dream trait. What's a Dream trait? Like seriously, is that just pure BS, or do you think they're going to use the Dream trait later on? Because
you could have a brand that interacts with Dream traits. Whenever you play a dream card, draw a card. Like, that's not that
hard. That's true, because you could have, like, Wolf Dream, you could have Green Dream.
Yeah, you can have... You can have,
You can have, Yeah, what other dreams?
Prophetic those dream. Two? You can call them all sorts of things.
Wet dreams.
Here's the thing, Alex. Since you have a car design, why don't you do wet dreams, like Stanton suggested, and I'll do a brand that keys off dreams.
I don't want to know what he keys off when you play wet dreams. All right. But something to note, both in, and we'll talk about Sir Alistair Thorne later, but both Wolf Dreams and Sir Alistair Thorne in this pack do something very specific, and that's kneel your faction card to trigger the effect.
We've seen some of that already.
Yeah, we have. We've seen Things I Do for Fealty. Love and Fealty and the Wildling Horde. I think that's it.
Yep.
In the core.
But as more and more cards come up with this cost, it actually might become a real cost. It's the old, maybe it's the new limited response. Because in 1.0 we had a limited response where we could only trigger one of these responses each round.
Mm-hmm. And this might start edging out, come relevant when we talk about the new agenda in this pack too, making fealty a different decision point, not only for the neutrals, but for the fact that you have to kneel your faction card to trigger it, and if you're including a lot of faction card kneeling in your deck, that might play against it as well. So I'm glad to see them use a little more of this, because obviously in the core set, it makes almost no difference, right? It just means that you can't play two Things I Do for Love in one phase, which you weren't going to do anyway because the gold cost is prohibitive. So
yeah.
I'm really glad to see them give more options to expand that base and perhaps compete with sort of the default fealty. All right. Well, let us move on then to Lord of the Crossing, John. What were you going to say about Lord of the Crossing?
Well,
besides,
I was going to say, this is the first new agenda we've seen.
The art is fantastic.
Oh, my God, yeah. I had this tiny little orgasm when I first saw it, and then later when I looked at it again, I had a much bigger one. So, yeah, the art's great.
Like, you can see Grey Wind and Rob and Caitlin walking up to the twins. You can see both sides of the twins. Like, that's just, that is great art.
Yeah, the person really knew the books. Sadly, the agenda isn't as empowering as the art in my mind. And I'll read it for our listeners. During the first challenge you initiate each phase, each of your participating characters get -1 strength. During the third challenge you initiate each phase, each of your participating characters get +2 strength. If you win this challenge, gain 1 power for your faction. It's not bad. I mean, and I'm actually, a lot of my decks, I'm struggling to find an agenda right now because I don't really want to be banner to someone. And I can't really use fealty because I want to use too many neutral cards. So I could see this slotting in those decks. But this seems to be an afterthought, not something I build my deck around currently.
See, I don't agree.
I'm with Alex with this. I want to see what his reasons are.
There are a couple of things. First, when I looked at it, I said it wasn't that powerful. But then I realized that I was comparing it to what I expect from first edition agendas, when really this is basically a replacement for fealty. It's forcing you to, you know, decide between fealty and it. And again, the more kneel effects we have for the house cards, the more we might want to lean towards this one. But I don't think you play this at all unless you have a strong icon balance, or you can, you know, reliably put in characters to do additional challenges like Olenna's Informant, or the plot that lets you do an additional military, or the location that lets you do an additional intrigue.
So what you're saying is this isn't useful unless you have a really good balance, or you're going to use these special things.
Or you have characters that that stand frequently. Like, for instance, there's that inbuilt
synergy. So it's not good most of the time.
With Randall Tark. He comes in for the third challenge. He automatically stands himself.
That's cool. There's a couple cool, funky things you can do with it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that generally it's not good, which is basically what you just said.
No, I actually think this has...
You gave me a long list
potential.
Of where it's not good.
So here are some examples of where I think it is good.
Okay.
What it does is it's interactive. It forces you to play your challenges differently, to declare them in an order you wouldn't have done normally, without completely rebuilding your deck.
I agree.
But, for instance, if you're playing against a burn deck, you're probably assuming they have Dracarys and they're going to burn out someone and it's going to be your Melisandre or someone important.
Let's stop right now. You're going to start quoting me a whole bunch of what if special scenarios where the agenda could be useful.
No, these are
I want to hear where it's useful. I want to hear where it's useful all the time.
Two payoffs. First of all, If you can use this agenda, it's generating a power turn, and in the current environment, renown is phenomenal, power is good, acceleration is good. If you're building just a straight-up aggro deck that can hit them in all three fronts, this will accelerate an aggro deck, which is something that aggro decks definitely need.
Okay, I'm gonna tell you right now that in the current environment, this card is garbage, straight garbage. You have to have a very good icon spread in order to make this card work. The only way to do that is with a banner right now.
And you can't banner because of Lord of the Crossing. You can't banner.
Exactly. This card is straight garbage.
I'm not saying that in a year from now or two chapter packs from now, it's not going to be good. What I'm saying is it's not good now, and it's not going to be good by the end of the cycle. Maybe the cycle after, when we get a box set or something introduced, and the box set changes up things, plus the cycle, then it might start to have some value.
But I think as soon as you have like neutral characters that have good icon spreads, you might want to look at this.
I agree with Stan.
I think that you guys are underestimating the ability to just have additional challenges. If you have Khal Drogo, you don't need a good icon spread. You're going to do two military challenges and a power challenge.
You'll just do an entry challenge at first, chump it up, and then
You don't even need
military challenge, get no bonus, and your third one you get +2 strength.
Yeah. I mean, if you're like
in the huge value there, I'd rather have a non-kneeling war host from Stark, or a one of the Lannisters banner characters like friggin' Jaime to support my Khal more than this agenda.
I think that the synergy with Stand and Randall, the synergy with the Red Viper in that your third challenge can get a whole bunch of extra strength, the synergy with
extra strength is +2.
Per character.
It is per character.
Yeah, okay.
But so here's the thing, right? I agree. Like that's pretty cool, right? I'm not gonna put this agenda in. So like two turns out of maybe five or six turns, it's gonna be super sweet.
I mean, I guess it goes good with the intimidate characters because they get the extra strength, so they can kneel more stuff.
Yeah,
but it's still the third challenge. Like you just are throwing away that first challenge.
Not necessarily. You can also use that for the first challenge that you were guaranteed to win anyway because of stealth or something else. And then push a challenge that you might not have won because you get the additional strength boost on it.
I feel like currently in the current card pool, you're rolling dice with it. You need that stealth carry. You need that other way to push that first challenge through.
I
agree with you, Alex, that in 6 months, it'll be a lot better. It's just right now I'm talking about it's not that great. And maybe that's what FFG is going for. Maybe they're trying to design a agenda that's actually going to stand the test of time and actually be good in 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years when they finally rotate it out. It'll be good in that time.
That would be great if they were that forward thinking. I would be super happy.
And surprised.
And surprised.
But let's be honest, that's a better way for it to be than being good right now. I'd rather that. So I'm hoping that's how they designed it because that's the way it's reading to me.
If this was more than that agenda,
the next card. which I like. He's 2 cost. He's got a military icon, 2 strength, and he has the text. He's a knight, by the way, in case you didn't get that from the name, Hedge Knight. When you control another knight character, Hedge Knight gets +1 strength and gains a power icon. That's actually pretty good.
So, real quick, just because I am not sure offhand, I'm going to see how many knight characters there are.
House Day Knight, Jaime Lannister, Loras Tyrell, or whatever he's called, Knight of Flowers, Vanguard Lancer. I know there's another one in there somewhere.
I mean, your naming cards, yep, that is not a number. House Day Knight, Davos, Jaime, Jorah, Waymar. Oh, way more. Knight of Flowers, Tumblestone Knight, Vanguard Lancing.
Tumblestone Knight. Two.
So Bear's got some knights.
No?
Bear's got 2 knights.
That's what I said, some knights.
Yeah.
Well, one of them is non-unique, too.
A pair of knights, yeah. And there's a plot right after that that keys off knights, right? It's 3-8-1. That says each knight character you control gains renown and immune to opponent's events. And it's a summer plot, which is super important because it has 6 reserve as well.
And it's not limit 1 per plot deck.
Yeah.
It's not, yeah.
This is
so. This is a possibility to create rush out of just about anyone that already has some knights.
Yeah, I think this is seriously. It has serious potential to be the plot that gives us a rush deck, and I think that rush deck might be ready in that third chapter pack.
With the Hedge Knight.
With the Hedge Knight and the fact that you could run it out of a banner deck and probably pull enough knights to reliably have, you know, three cheap renowned characters on the board. And three cheap renowned characters on the board is good.
Yep.
And
that you, initiative two, you're going first.
Yep. And so are we just kind of, like, obviously, like, the rush house right now is, like, Martell, who also has, like, a knight. Like a non-unique knight.
The rush house is Martell. Greyjoy. I would have said Greyjoy right now, which does not have a knight.
So, like, the immediate, I guess, like, Greyjoy seems more aggro, but, like, straight-up power rush seems Martell. Like, it's a bit delayed, which I've always liked better anyway.
Yeah, Martell seems like a delayed rush. I'd agree with that. You know, the Viper feels like that, where you build up to you have a big mass of characters. They all attack at once. The Viper claims a lot of power. Right, so which, I agree with that.
Yeah, which, like, Tourney for the King, I think that's what it does. Mm-hmm. Build up, like, a bunch of characters.
Yeah, bunch of knights, and then just plow through that one challenge that makes the difference.
Yep.
I think it'll be fun, and I think it does it in a way that doesn't make Greyjoy better. So that's sad, but...
Well, it's probably good, actually, right? Like, if it's we already think good. Of it as the
rush house... If we're already thinking house, of it as the rush house.
Rush yeah. fastest house. Tough to balance, right? Like, that was the problem with Barrow in first edition, that they kept saying, okay, we're going to change this, and then it made it too powerful that it would win on turn one or turn two. And they said, oh, damn, we can't have games in the end turn one. That's negative play experience for the people on the other side of the board. And it's super hard to balance. So maybe they
did
the
right thing. I like how that is somehow MPE... But, like, someone sitting there, like, controlling your entire board.
14
being
plus.
Choked out for 12 turns, yeah. That's negative play experience, too.
Yeah, exactly.
But the people that get owned in one round complain more because they have more time to complain.
That's right. They have 55 right? minutes
they between rounds. 55 rounds. Minutes to complain instead of six or right. three at the end of the round.
All right. Well, there's one more card who's also a knight in this pack. This is Sir Alistair Thorne. Who's a Night's Watch 6-cost character with a military and a power icon. 4 strength, non-loyal, knight and ranger. While you are the defending player, each Night's Watch character you control gains a military icon. And he has a reaction. After a military challenge is initiated against you, kneel your faction card and pay 4 gold to put Sir Alistair Thorne into play from your hand.
That's pretty cool. It's like ambush. Kinda.
It's really good. This is the kind of card, just like that plot we were talking about earlier, that makes a defense strategy work. If you are forcing someone to win on defense, they need to have things that are not already on the board that can surprise win a challenge, because your opponent can tell whether you can win a challenge on defense.
Yeah.
Right?
So all of a sudden, all those friggin' builders you had all have mill icons or
and
stewards or whatever.
He himself can come in and add his force.
Oh, yeah.
Too. So you can really say, okay, yeah, now I'm turning this to I can defend for 12 in military challenge, and I can win that, and then I can play Sword in the Darkness or, yeah.
And not only that, Messenger Raven, potentially 2 strength military icon out of nowhere.
It's true.
Isn't he 1 strength? Is he 2?
But if you have the wall, though.
Oh, okay, if you have the wall, yeah.
Yeah.
The Raven. One thing Grey Wind is good for, eating Messenger Ravens.
Yeah.
I think this is really good design. The only catch is that I think you'll never, ever want to play the 6 gold to play him.
This is going to sound strange. The one thing I don't like about this character is that he has a power icon, because I don't feel like it's following the theme of Nightwatch, which I thought was like all these monocon. If you're a ranger, you have a military icon. If you're a builder, it's a power. If it's a steward, it's an intrigue. Why does this guy have 2 icons as well? Like, so super prominent, super powerful guys,
so
I understand.
So Royce also had a power icon.
I mean, Jon Snow, just the intrigue. And he's one of those guys that I would have thought had a military. He was training in Winterfell all the time. You know, I forgive him. He's 7 cost. I don't forgive this guy. 1 icon.
Yeah, no, I think like the big unique people in the Night's Watch are going to be Bicon. I actually think that Jon Snow only has an entry icon merely for design purpose?
Can't like balance purpose?
Well, not quite. I think there's also a Nedley reason, not because he should be very intriguey, but because he's assigned to the stewards and he wants to be so much more.
Yeah, but he is a military guy. He is a ranger.
That's right. That's why he participates in the ranging. He wants to go out and find Benjen. He wants to, you know, do this. And so that's what his card effect says. His card effect says, while other people are going out and doing things, he joins in.
To some effect, I think he should just be holding all three icons to start with. We were looking at from the books and these other characters that have been printed. So to me, he set a precedent. And the precedent was the trait determines the icons. And now we're seeing a lot of characters.
Okay, but we have Ranger Party, which is military power bicon in the core. And we have Sir Weimar Royce, which is military power bicon in the core. So
ask me if I agree with those characters, those cards. And the answer is no, Alex, I don't agree with those cards.
But you're saying that there's a trend.
You're also breaking the trend. Stop breaking the trend.
You're saying there's a trend for Rangers when there are
Ranger,
more
military
Rangers.
Only. No, that's all I want to hear.
How many Rangers are military only? Come on.
So this is also a problem with making Night's Watch its own house, which I completely disagree with. But if you're going to make them their own house, you have to just give them a lot of like these bicon characters. Otherwise, they're just garbage.
All right. They're forced to do it for balance reasons. I can buy into it. They've destroyed the whole theme of the Night's Watch, and I'm sad for it.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. So thanks, Titan, for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
So that last segment ran longer than we were expecting.
It's because Stanton has so much to say, which is absolutely correct, because I think he agreed with me most of the time.
I managed to cut about 25 minutes of that, so it sounds like he agrees with us both equally.
Damn it!
I don't have much for closing comments, so hopefully we can get this episode wrapped up in time. I did want to mention UK Nationals, which are not this next weekend. They're on the 12th of September, so there's a little ways off, and hopefully we'll get some more information for you guys about that. But there's nothing that I know of this coming weekend.
I have some news. Little C is a little sad that we didn't mention that Dragon Pit might be one of the best decks in the meta. And I think Alex actually thinks it is the best deck. And we had mentioned on a previous podcast a couple of decks, but we didn't say that, you know, Dragon Pit is really good. So for Little C, I'm going to give that a shout out.
So that's news that isn't news that is in our closing comments.
Correct.
Works for me.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
And some of you people that are joining us for 2.0 may not know him, but he is Staglord on basically all the forums, and he's played this game.
No, I'm not forever. Staglord.
Oh, who are you then?
I'm just Staten.
Just Staten?
Yeah, where'd Staglord is actually a New York, like an old school like New York meta player.
Oh, see, that just confuses me, because that's who I always thought you were.
No, I'm just, like, Staten on the forums.
But you've been playing for, what, like, Bera, 10 years?
And you've been playing Bera, basically, the whole time.
And it's really awkward because, like, Staglord is actually a Targaryen play.
Wow. This has just blown my mind.
What kind of worm?